Good morning, and welcome to the beginning of a new year of medical ethics and medical halacha shiurim. Michael, just leave it a little bit open, please, that way people can still know they can come in. Thank you. I want to thank Bayit Adult Education, as always, for co-sponsoring. As well as Dr. Kirshen for his help in getting us the CME credits and in general guiding the series. Our topic this morning is vaccination and halacha. December, I will be speaking at Shari Shamayim. The next one in the series is Shari Shamayim. I'm not sure what I had as the topic there. But January, we'll be back here, God willing, and the topic here will be one that I actually did at Shari Shemayim last year, which is the topic of providing medical treatment for terrorists at the scene of attack, after an attack, and so forth. So that'll be the January topic. As always, everything I say in this shiur should not be taken as psak. This is not meant as practical guidance. We are discussing halachic issues, but for practical things, please speak to your rabbi. And finally, please make sure that you sign in, both to get follow-up on the class, and for those who want the CME credit, you'll need to sign in as well. The topic of vaccination in halacha has actually seen quite a few great articles written in the last dozen or so years, many of them available online. You'll see some of them quoted in the source sheet. But I think what I'll probably do is when I send out the follow-up email after the class, I'll also send a bunch of links to some of the articles that are available, because there's some very good ones on different aspects of the issues. Some have been written on preventive medicine in general, some have been written on vaccination, some have been written on the history of the halacha in this regard. So I think what I'm going to do is send out the bibliography, at least of some articles that are available online, for those who want more reading. The problem is that the topic is so big that what I'm going to have to do in certain aspects of this is go for breadth over depth, meaning that I'm going to be quoting certain opinions where I would like to be able to go into depth for where they got their ideas from and so forth, but we would spend the entire shiur just on their opinions, and we can't have that because there's so much to say. So I apologize for that. Do the best we can with what is a very big topic. I begin with source number one, which actually you can see the date on the article. It came out just last week. From the Infectious Diseases Society of America, entitled "Always Deadly Measles Complication More Common Than Believed." And this showed up in quite a few places. There was a press release initially that was then picked up in the media. Subacute sclerosing panencephalitis, which is a lot easier to say as SSPE, is a neurological disorder that is 100% fatal. Infants younger than 12 months who are too young to receive measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine can get infected with measles and later develop SSPE, which may lay dormant for years. While it was once thought the risk of post-measles SSPE was 1 in 100,000, recent research identified a rate as low as 1 in 1,700 in Germany among children infected with measles before they were 5 years old. And the new study found it is about 1 in 600 for those who get measles as infants before being vaccinated. So in other words, what we're saying is, child may get measles, and you think it's over once the measles ends, and in fact, there's a complication there, which is described as being 100% fatal. There is no cure for SSPE, and the only way to prevent it is to vaccinate everyone against measles. So you're talking about a concern that people don't even see at the time, which is avoidable if the child doesn't get measles in the first place. They talk about a particular vulnerability for a child who's too young to receive the vaccine. So on the one hand, we're talking about a potentially fatal complication. And then on the other hand, take a look at source number two, which is part of a series of letters that I'm going to come back to later that went around the Lakewood, New Jersey, really over a period of years, over the past 10 years, really, regarding the question of whether schools are allowed to exclude children who are not vaccinated. It's talking about yeshivot, it's talking about Jewish schools, where there are children who are enrolled in the school whose parents decided not to vaccinate them, and the school says, well, you know, we have a mission. Our mission is to provide a Torah education for everybody. We're not willing to exclude the students who are not vaccinated. And the parents, often, who are vaccinating, lobby and say, we don't want to send our child to a school where he'll be exposed to kids who are not vaccinated. Because even if you have a vaccine, that doesn't guarantee 100% immunity. And if you're exposed to a child who's carrying it, then you could still be vulnerable. So what you see in this is a letter that was issued, a very controversial letter. Rabbi Shmuel Meir Katz, Rabbi Shmuel Kamenetsky, and Rabbi Malkiel Kahler, each one a significant name in their own right. Rabbi Katz is a dayan, a judge on Beis Din in Lakewood. Rabbi Shmuel Kamenetsky of the yeshiva in Philadelphia. Rabbi Malkiel Kahler of Lakewood, New Jersey. This is part of their letter. It's not the full letter, and it's important to emphasize that because they do talk about the importance of health and vaccination and so forth. But they also write, after considering the nature of the current outbreak, the very high percentage of fully vaccinated individuals among the mumps cases, the serious risks associated with the MMR vaccine, and the halachic gravity of denying a child acceptance to school even for one day, it is our opinion that unless truly obligated to do so by law, no school has the right to deny a child acceptance to school on the grounds that he or she has not received the MMR vaccine. It is incumbent upon the menahalim, heads of the school, to ensure that school nurses act in this regard in accordance with halacha and not based on secular medical advice alone. So they're saying you can't exclude the child from the school. On the one hand, we have people saying there's a potentially fatal complication, and on the other hand, you have them saying you can't exclude the child from the school based on the high percentage of fully vaccinated individuals, the risks of the vaccine, and we're going to come back to these factors. But this shows that this is a very real question within the within sectors of the Jewish community. Yes.
Have they stayed consistent since the outbreaks in Israel and other places?
So the last letter that I saw on this was Tashin Ayin Dalet, so 2014. Was an additional letter saying that you can't keep the kids from school. I haven't seen anything since then. But 2014, which I think was after some of the outbreaks in Israel already, the bottom line is, yeah, I think that they were maintaining this stance, at least at that point. There were some who signed on letters like this originally and then backed out. So not everybody has stayed with this. Yeah. Sorry? Well, that's what... Well, they don't say not to vaccinate, and they actually talk about the importance of it, but they say we can't compel somebody to use it because there are risks associated. They're not actually banning the vaccine, no. David? I'm going to leave that to the doctors rather than to me. Is mumps potentially fatal? Correct. So David points out the potential, and I'm getting this thing here, that it would be rare for mumps to be fatal. So the argument could be, well, that's your difference. Sorry?
All these illnesses in adults are much more severe.
Interesting. In adults, they're much more severe. Okay. I mean, but the problem you can still run into, and again, you know, I'm the one who's not the doctor here, is that MMR has three letters in it, right? You still have the concern for measles, and you still have the concern for rubella, which, if I'm remembering correctly, is a big danger for pregnant women. And when you recognize the population you're speaking to, right, where these are families who are going to have, you know, 6, 8 and more children, there would be a risk for the child carrying it to the mother. So that's an additional concern. Which is also an issue. So yes. Okay. So we're on the introduction, folks. So I think we're going to actually get into this year, because otherwise, really, we're not going to get anywhere. So I apologize, but we're going to move forward here. What I'm going to be working with in general for this year, for the next hour and change, will be the issues of vaccinations for childhood illness, as well as flu. And there are a range of vaccinations. There are more that we're not going to get to. For example, you talk about the HPV vaccination. That introduces a whole bunch of other halachic issues, which I'm not going to be able to get to today. But what I want to do is at least cover these very basic ones and the questions that they raise. So the questions I want to address are, number one, if you have a vaccine that is determined to be safe. Let's say we have a vaccine that no one's claiming is dangerous. So is there a halakhic obligation to vaccinate oneself against disease? So removing the question of the danger of the vaccine, is there an obligation to use vaccines? I'm not sick. That's question number one. Question number two is, how does a vaccine become considered proper medical treatment within the eyes of halakha? What kind of threshold of certainty do you need? Do we worry about the fact that the vaccine could itself be dangerous? How do we come to accept a vaccine within halakha? Third, is there an obligation to vaccinate one's children as a parent? And then last, is a community able to compel vaccination of students or of healthcare workers? So those are the things that I would like to be able to address today, and let's get started. Assuming you had a vaccine that you considered to be safe without question, would there be a religious duty to vaccinate oneself? So without a doubt, halacha is very careful with a person's health. We are familiar with pikuach nefesh, the idea that guarding a life is considered paramount and overrides almost everything else within the Torah. But not just that, preservation of one's health in general, even when it's not life and death. If you take a look at source number 3, this is a classic Gemara involving a conversation between Rav Huna and his son, Rabba. Amalei Rav Huna le Rabba Barei. Rav Huna says to his son Rabba, "My time alo shichas kamei de Rav Chisda, the Machadin and Shmaitzei. Why are you not going to Rav Chisda's shir, Rav Chisda's lecture?" Rav Huna and Rav Chisda are sparring partners often in the Gemara. They debate with each other. Rav Huna says to his son, "You should be going to Rav Chisda's classes. I'm actually going to stick with reading the English aloud in the interest of time, but you have the Hebrew on the sources as well." So he says, why aren't you learning with Rav Chisda? To which Rabba says, because when I go to a shir, he asks me about mundane things. He says to me, you know, a person who goes to the washroom shouldn't sit immediately, shouldn't press himself too hard. He's giving me all this advice about you know, using the outhouse. So Rav Huna says, he's involved in human life, and you call that mundane? These are issues of health. You certainly should go. If he's going to spend this year giving you medical advice, you certainly should go to the class. That's the statement that he makes to his son. And I think it tells us something very important about preservation of one's health, that this is actually a requirement. Source number 4 is a very important source. It's where the Rambam speaks about the importance of maintaining one's health. He says, having a healthy whole body is from the paths of God, as one can neither understand nor know anything about God when ill. Therefore, one must distance himself from anything which damages the body. One must accustom himself to behaviors which increase health and strength. In other words, don't simply say it's important to guard your health because you want to be, because you want to save your life, but it's a religious value. It's about your relationship with Hashem also. How many times do you have an opportunity to go to a class and you say, I have a headache, right? You have a headache, so you should be doing something to prevent headaches, that you'll be able to go to more shiurim and learn more Torah. So the value of preserving your health, and not only in terms of life and death, comes out in a myriad of sources. I only brought you two here just because these, I think, represent it rather well. We have a specific losas day, a specific prohibition against creating or entering into dangerous situations. So an example of that in source number 5, Rabbi Nassan said, how do we know that you're not allowed to raise a kelev ra, a bad dog, in your home? When we say bad dog, we mean a dog that's a risk for attacking people. How do we know that you're not allowed to raise such a dog in your home? And also, if there's a ladder with a weak rung, you're not allowed to set that up in your home such that somebody might climb on it. And they quote you a pasuk from Sefer Devarim, and it's the pasuk regarding ma'akeh. Right? The mitzvah of ma'akeh is the mitzvah that if I have a roof that people sometimes walk on, and it is more than, call it, 3 to 4 feet up from the next level below, the ground or whatever would be the next level onto which people would fall, I am obligated to set up a wall around it. in order to make sure that people do not fall off. And that's a very important mitzvah. Not everybody is cognizant of it, but it's a very important mitzvah. And there, the Torah says, "V'lo sasim damim b'beisacha." You shall not place blood in your home, which the Gemara explains to mean, not only am I obligated to fence in my roof to make sure people don't fall off the roof, but I'm obligated to avoid any dangerous situation in my home. So I'm obligated to put the cleaning fluids or whatever out of reach of small children. I'm obligated to make sure that I don't have steps that people could fall through. All the different ways that you have to protect people who are within your home. And the Rambam codifies this as a mitzvah, a biblical mitzvah. In source number 6, it's Lo Sasein 298, which I find to be funny. The Rambam, I don't know if he had a sense of humor or not. What is 298 in Hebrew? In the Gematria, what would you do for 298? Retzach, Reish Sadi Ches. Retzach is murder. So the Rambam said, how the Rambam assigned numbers to the mitzvos is actually very cryptic. It's not at all clear. But in this case, he writes, in his introduction of this mitzvah, he, Hashem, commanded us not to leave obstacles and stumbling blocks in our lands and homes, lest people die by them. That is a lo sase. That's a biblical prohibition. It's brought in the Shulchan Aruch and Choshen Mishpat Tavchav Zayin. And you may be familiar with a principle that Talmud mentions quite a few times, comes up in Halacha, Chamira Sakanta Me'isura, which means danger is more strict than prohibition. Meaning, when I'm dealing with prohibitions, if a prohibition is very unlikely, I'm entitled to say, I don't need to worry about that. However, if I'm dealing with a threat, if I'm dealing with danger, then I'm not entitled to saying, don't worry about it, it's only a very slim minority of cases. I still have to be concerned. And an example of that, actually, that comes up for people is the issue of fish and meat. The Gemara in Pesachim talks about a fear that if a person were to cook fish and meat together in certain ways, then eating one of them would be harmful. And from that has evolved the practice of not eating fish and meat together, but instead having separate plates, and you clean your mouth out in between, and so forth. Whether that's really dangerous in our understanding of biology or not is not my point. My point is this: the hechsherim, the kosher certification bodies, encounter a situation in which there is a sauce called Worcestershire sauce, and it has fish in it. But the fish is less than 1 in 60. So the question is, do they need to label it fish, or can they say, well, no, it's batel. The fish in it is considered nullified, just like in kashrus in general. Something is nullified at less than 1 in 60. However, chamira sakanta me'isura, maybe when you're dealing with danger, 1 in 60 doesn't help. 1 in 60 is a halachic concept, and you're dealing with prohibitions. But it doesn't necessarily apply when you're dealing with danger, and therefore, they'll write fish, even if it's less than 1 in 60. On the label. Okay. So we have a lo sase, we have a prohibition of don't create dangerous situations. Beyond that though, and very important for us, is a mitzvah ase, an active mitzvah of avoiding danger. That's a very important thing, because what we were talking about in vaccinating is actually asking you to get up and do. So is there also a mitzvah of get up and do to avoid danger? We know there's a mitzvah of get up and do to put up a makeh, but take a look at the Rambam in source number 7. The Rambam writes, so too, there is a commandment to remove any stumbling block which endangers lives and to guard from it, and to be very careful with this, as he quotes a pasuk in Sefer Devarim, guard yourself and guard your life. So he says, not only am I supposed to keep away from danger, but I have an active mitzvah of removing anything that could be dangerous. And if one doesn't remove it, one leaves dangerous stumbling blocks, he fails to fulfill a commandment, meaning you missed out on an asay, on a mitzvah. And he violates the prohibition as well of do not place blood, which we talked about before. The Rambam says there is indeed a mitzvah saseh. Now, the truth of the matter is that Halacha Kefaris challenged this. The Minchas Tinuch in Tav Kuf Mem Vav notes that pasuk the Rambam quoted, the one that he came from Devarim 4, right, which said, Hishomer lecha shmor nafshecha, guard yourself and guard your life. If you look at it in context in the Torah, has nothing to do with protecting yourself from danger. It's talking about not forgetting what happened at Har Sinai. And that leads to some debate as to whether this is actually a biblical mitzvah or whether it's a rabbinic mitzvah as being linked to a biblical verse. That is a mitzvah is not really a question. The only question is the threshold. What level is this obligation to guard yourself from harm? But as a result of everything that we've just said, as a result of the clear biblical prohibition against having a dangerous situation around, as well as the active mitzvah, biblical or rabbinic, of removing harm, halachic authorities clearly require using medical methods to avoid harm. Those who were here when we talked about genetic screening may remember source number 8, in which Rabbi Moshe Feinstein said that failure to check oneself with genetic screening when it's available and easy to use and so forth, he says, it's like closing your eyes before that which you could see. He says, you're not entitled to cross the street with your eyes closed and say, well, I'm not obligated to look, and, you know, God is going to look out for me. So, too, if you're going to get married, you're going to have children, you have a responsibility to undergo genetic screening. How it's going to be done, who's going to be informed, those are all things that have to be worked out, and that was our shir. But but you're not entitled to close your eyes. You have an obligation, and further, look at the Rambam in source number 9. Where the Rambam writes, the sage has prohibited many activities because they endanger lives, right, like the meat fish example that we mentioned, regarding anyone who transgresses and who says, I will endanger myself, what business is it of others, or I don't care about the danger, we issue lashes of rebellion for him. He says the Beis Din, the rabbinical court, is entitled to issue lashes. Lashes of rebellion are a particular kind of penalty for someone who violates rabbinic law. And the reason the Rambam invokes a rabbinic thing, even though he has called it a biblical mitzvah, is because the biblical mitzvah is structured in such a way that it doesn't carry a penalty. There is no biblical penalty for violating this law. And he says, okay, but the rabbis have at their discretion the ability to punish him anyway. We don't want people endangering themselves and saying, well, it's none of your business. So far, what we understand is that there is a mitzvah of avoiding harm and avoiding dangerous situations, even carrying a penalty for it. However, you can't tell me that this is really an obligation to avoid all harm whatsoever, right? Because if it really was, we wouldn't be here today, because we wouldn't have gotten out of bed, right? You get up out of bed and your blood pressure shifts. You go out into the street, and who knows what can happen. Realistically, we all do take certain risks in the course of our lives. And if we're going to put it in the vaccination context, today with herd immunity to many diseases, the risk of contracting some of these diseases, smallpox, right, is generally very low. Now, two caveats once I start bringing vaccines into the discussion. Number one, if people stop vaccinating themselves, then herd immunity is suddenly gone. So, that's herd immunity, for anyone who's not familiar with the term, is the idea that if you have a very high percentage of the population, 90%, 95%, whatever it is, being vaccinated, then realistically, the disease is not able to survive and be communicated within the community. So that would be the idea of herd immunity. But once you knock your percentage down, because people say, well, herd immunity, I don't need to worry, then you once again have this problem. And as I noted earlier, even people who are vaccinated will be vulnerable because, again, the vaccination does not provide 100% immunity, and therefore it's possible for them to contract this. One of the epidemics that triggered this series of articles in the last 10 to 15 years came out of a situation in a summer camp. There was a child from England who had not been vaccinated and went to a summer camp in the United States. It was a Jewish summer camp at which the campers actually engaged in study for a good chunk of the day. And you know the way that we study. The way that we study in a base medrash is chavrusa, partner study. You're sitting opposite the table from the person and one is breathing at the other. That's the way it works. And they discovered an outbreak. I don't remember if it was mumps or measles. I think it was mumps. But there was a terrible outbreak that came about because this student was a carrier of, the student slash camper was a carrier of mumps, and he was able to infect a whole bunch of others at the summer camp, including kids who actually had been vaccinated. Because again, the vaccine is not 100%. So the caveats that I have to give when we ask the question of, do I really need to vaccinate if everybody else is getting vaccinated, is that number one, failure to vaccinate reduces herd immunity, and number two, it will expose others to harm. But let's say you didn't have to worry about those two points. Just a question for myself personally. Do I need to vaccinate if I'm dealing with a very low-risk situation? So the truth of the matter is that we have precedent in halacha for accepting low levels of risk. One source which we've discussed in other contexts is source number 10, the Gemara in Bava Metzia. I'm going to say it outside of the source itself, but I wanted you to have the source there as well. The Gemara talks about the Torah's obligation to pay a person on the day that the person does a job. Somebody does a job for you, and they're paid by the hour or by the day. You have to pay them before the sun goes down. And the Torah emphasizes the plight of the pauper who took this job so that he could put food on the table. And it says, "Ve'elav hu noseyas nafsho," which the Gemara explains to mean he puts his life on the line for the sake of your job. How dare you not pay the person on time? That's the way the Gemara reads it, and the Gemara describes him climbing the tree and putting himself in danger. Well, the question is, what do you mean climbing the tree and putting himself in danger? If he's putting himself in danger, that's not allowed. Who justified him to put himself in danger? To which the Gemara's answer is, and the answer of halacha is, that you're allowed to put yourself in certain levels of risk in order to accomplish certain goals. And we're going to come back to that and give some better definition to that in a moment. But that's what emerges from this Gemara, is there is such a thing as tolerable risk. And so maybe somebody will say, I'm allowed to tolerate the risk of the of getting sick. And by the way, we all know this. We all know this. We don't necessarily think about it. However, you come to shul, Torah reading, somebody gets up and gets an aliyah, or just in general, somebody gets up and makes a bracha. And the bracha is Birkas HaGomel, in which he thanks Hashem for saving him. Saving him from what? So the Gemara gives us four different cases in which one is required to make such a bracha. One of them, let's say, is traveling across the water, traveling through the wilderness, and you're in danger, and Hashem has saved you from danger. Who entitled you to go out to sea? Who entitled you to go through the wilderness? If you believe it's dangerous enough, but afterwards you have to thank God for saving you, what business did you have going off to sea in the first place? The answer is that there are risks which we are indeed justified in taking. Otherwise, you couldn't have Birkas HaGomel at all. That's very clear. And then the most cited source is source number 11, a very important source. There's a pasuk in Tehillim, Shomer Tzayim Hashem. Hashem guards the fools. And the Gemara considers two situations which are considered dangerous. One is bris milah, circumcision. The other is bloodletting on a cloudy day or a day when the south wind blows. Right now we're not going to go into why those should be considered harmful situations or dangerous situations. That's what the Gemara takes as dangerous situations. And it says, well, then why are we allowed to do this? Why is it okay? Because Hashem guards people who are foolish. So again, we see a level of risk tolerance. So the question then has to be, what's our justification, what's our standard for a risk that we're allowed to accept? There are three different approaches, all of which are considered important approaches in halacha and practical considerations. The first is the simplest. And that's Reb Chaim Ozer. Reb Chaim Ozer, writing towards the beginning of the 20th century, said it's a question of percentages. How likely is the danger? At a certain threshold, you can say, I don't need to worry about it anymore. Below a certain point, you don't need to worry. If you take a look at source number 12, Reb Chaim Ozer, one of the great halachic authorities from the first half of the 20th century, says, one must conclude, he's dealing with a woman for which there was a fear, going back to the Gemara, that she should not, you don't want her to conceive. It would be dangerous for her to conceive. And yet she's allowed to have sexual relations with her husband. So he says, why is she allowed to do so? And the Gemara gives the answer that we gave before, God guards the fools. Shomer Psayim Hashem, don't worry about it. So Reb Chaim Ozer says, one must conclude that conception in that particular case is very unlikely to be a concern. A rare minority of cases. And the sages weren't concerned for this. For this one may rely upon God guards the fools. So what Reb Chaim Ozer said is that if the likelihood is very low, then You can just say, don't worry about it. And that comes up in a variety of recent halakhic authorities, the Divrei Malkiel, Rav Malkiel Tenenbaum, the Rav Moshe Feinstein actually quoted it in the case as well. He's Rav Moshe said, distancing yourself from a low-risk danger is not obligatory. It may be a good thing to do, but it's not obligatory if this is very low risk. J. David Blythe mentioned it as well. He said, otherwise, who could go out on a boat trip? You want to go out on a boat for a nice, enjoyable cruise. Who gave you the right to do that? Clearly, there must be some level at which we say, this is not a concern. Well, how low is very low? Right? So what's your number that you're willing to accept? So, when you deal with this, I always like to point out the statement of Rav Asher Weiss. Rav Asher Weiss, in dealing with the topic, Rav Asher Weiss is the posek for Shaare Tzedek Hospital in Israel. So, he says that when you're dealing with percentages in halacha, as we are in this particular situation, the sages didn't deal in statistical analysis. There were, we like to apply percentages. And so there's a classic, for example, that comes up in this discussion. In other discussions, the Mishkan of Yaakov, writing in the 19th century, says that miud hamatsui, a minority that's considered significant and common, is at 10%. 10% of cases is already something you have to worry about. Rav Asher Weiss says they didn't deal with statistics. It's much more about an overall sense of safety or danger. Do people view this as being dangerous? And we actually find that in a comment by Rav Yitzchak Zilberstein quoting Rosh Shlomo Zalman Orbach. You have to jump on your sheet to get to it because I decided in the middle to change the order somewhat for this. Take a look at source number 17, and then we're going to come back to the other sources. He quotes the Mincha Shlomo, Shlomo Zalman Orbach, who himself is quoting Rabbi Akiva Eger, regarding what is considered to be Safek Pikuach Nefesh. You know, we say that on Shabbos, you're supposed to violate Shabbos to protect the life, and not only when you know somebody needs it, but even when you think somebody might need it. Well, you could always say somebody might need it. What am I supposed to do? Someone is coughing really hard. I don't know. Maybe there's something wrong in their lungs. How do you decide what is considered enough risk to violate Shabbos? So take a look at source number 17. He says, one can see from this, from the discussion of Shlomo Zalman Orbach, that the Mincha Shlomo, Shlomo Zalman, is of the opinion that if most people assume that not being vaccinated is a sakana, is a danger, then although the possibility of danger is quite remote, in specific situations it will be permitted to desecrate Shabbos in order to be vaccinated. And surely someone must obtain vaccination on a weekday, since the public considers not vaccinating to be a sakana, albeit a remote danger. What he's saying in the context of, I won't leave out the Shabbos discussion at the moment, but what he's trying to say here is, if in general people believe that being unvaccinated is dangerous, is a threat to life, that's called safek pikuach nefesh. That's called a potential threat to life. And now you're not allowed to say, so I'm going to accept the risk. That's no longer tolerated. Yes? So the people is the general population. It's not Jewish specific. It's society in general. I would argue it's probably a local society, but I can't prove that. Yes?
I wonder whether he's talking about public policy, then. Whether he's saying that if public policy is that it's a good idea to be vaccinated,
so I'm not sure he's saying public policy. I think he's really emphasizing the feeling of danger. In other words, if I'm going to vaccinate because, well, I need that to get my kids into school, but I don't actually feel like anybody's in danger. I don't think that's the same thing as a sense of danger. There was a hand here. So the threshold for the Achiezer, for Chaim Ozer, to say, well, you only need to do this if you feel like you're in is if the risk is substantive and not very low, it really may be a subjective thing. That's one way to do this. A second way to calculate is from Rabbi Yaakov Ettlinger, and you go back to source number 14 now, in the Binyan Sion, writing in 19th century Germany. He adds a factor, and actually in the interest of time, I'm not going to say it inside the text, but you can see it there on the sheet. He says, it's not only about the level of danger, although he does mention that, but it's also whether there's a danger here right now, or we're talking about a future concern, something that may be an issue down the line, right? Vaccination. nations, generally speaking, in our society, are not dealing with a present danger. We're not talking about vaccinating somebody during a polio outbreak, during a rubella outbreak. What we're talking about is you're going to vaccinate the child when the child is a year, 2 years, 3 years, whatever the course of that particular vaccination is, out of fear that they might be exposed at some point. So he says, if you're dealing with a concern that is itself for a minority of cases, that's one point that he mentions, and number two, it's for a risk that's in the future, it's not something that is currently there, then you could make the argument that there's no need. He's not dealing with vaccination per se, but in general. So, for example, I'm going to go on a boat. You're going to tell me there might be a storm, and if there's a storm, the boat's going to be in danger. So look at the weather report. The weather report says everything is fine. You're going to tell me, well, the weather reports are wrong all the time. I'm going to say to you, yes, nonetheless, I'm allowed to go out on the boat because right now there is no risk, and the risk you're talking about in any case, you know, even if there were a storm, would not rise to such a high level, and therefore I'm allowed to go out on the boat and I'm not considered to be endangering my life. Are we clear on the distinction between the first and second approaches? The first approach just says percentage. Second approach says percentage, and is the risk present right now, or are you talking about something that could develop? And then there's a third approach. And the third approach looks at reward. What's the justification for you actually exposing yourself to this potential harm? So that the Shem Aryeh, Rabbi Aryeh Lipschitz, in source number 15, talks about people going off to sea in the Mediterranean, and he says you're not supposed to go out for a pleasure cruise. He doesn't want you going to sea off on a pleasure trip just because you want to go tour the world. However, he says, if it's for Parnassa, for your livelihood, then it is indeed going to be justified. And that is mirrored in the Gemara that we saw in source number 10. It talked about the pauper putting his life on the line. Why? In order to be able to feed his family. So for that, he's allowed to climb the tree. But otherwise, we don't want him climbing the tree just for fun. That's considered to be taking a risk for a frivolous purpose. Now, there's some debate as to what exactly constitutes an appropriate purpose. Take a look at source number 16, please, the Gemara in Brachos. Mishnah says, even if a snake is wrapped around one's ankle, he should not stop Shmona Esrei. I'll take a poll on how many people would actually... I'm a little curious as to how that would play out. Actually, that's part of the discussion in the Gemara. I shouldn't say no, but
python?
Sorry,
python.
Yeah, we're thinking python, rattlesnake. You know, so Rav Shesha says that's only for snakes. Scorpions, on the other hand, you should stop. The scorpion is much more likely to sting. I was always biased by this. I went out to a shul in Phoenix, and I was talking to the rabbi there, and apparently, like, scorpions are common, and people get stung, and it's not fatal, and they, you know, they deal with it. But I was always biased by the Gemara. I think scorpion is more fatal than a snake. But the point from this is that, it seems like from this Gemara, you're allowed to take risk for the sake of a mitzvah. Right? That's what it sounds like the Gemara is saying. Nonetheless, others disagree and say, no, a mitzvah is not justification either. And as for this Gemara, it's because, as the Imre Shefer's point of view, commenting on this, he says, in this case, it's because the snake won't strike unless God tells it to strike. The snake is sent by God, and therefore you'll be okay. Again, your mileage may vary. But the point is that we now have three different ways to gauge whether you're allowed to take a risk. One, what's the percentage of risk? Two, is it a present danger or is it something that could develop in the future? And three, what's your justification for engaging in the activity? Is it something that you need to do or is it something that you just want to do? And all three of those are cited as halacha. I should also note that even if you're dealing with a low-level future risk, no one says you're allowed to ignore risk. The principle of Shomer P'sayim Hashem, that God guards people who are foolish, is not carte blanche for a person to say, so I don't need to protect myself as well, and it may not apply in cases of vaccination. Take a look at source number 18, Rabbi J. David Bleich, who is very strong in his language regarding the importance of vaccination, although, interestingly, he also is on the side of not compelling parents, I believe. But take a look at number 18. He says, nor can the principle of Shomer Ptaim be invoked to justify assumption of a recognized danger that can be readily averted. That is clearly the import of the statement of Rav Moshe Feinstein, the one regarding genetic screening, to the effect that with the development of blood tests to determine whether prospective marriage partners are both carriers of the gene responsible for Tay-Sachs disease, one may no longer rely upon Shomer Ptaim in assuming the risk of that disease. In other words, even if you say it's low level, it's in the future, and I need to participate in this activity, if you have an easy way to insulate yourself from harm, you're obligated to take it, and you can't say, Shomer Psayim Hashem. He says, for precisely the same reason, a danger posed by childhood disease, for which a vaccine is available, may not be assumed on the plea of Shomer Ptaim. And then he goes on to a comment by Rav Elyashiv, in which we say the following. He says, one second. That is certainly the import of the statement attributed to the late Rav Yosef Shalom Elyashiv, to the effect that failure to immunize would amount to negligence. Perfection of vaccines that immunize against disease results in a situation in which failure to vaccinate is tantamount to willfully exposing oneself to tzinim pachim. The Gemara says that Hashem is in control of everything except for what? Well, usually the answer is Yiras Hashem, right? Yiras Shemayim. It says Hakol Bidei Shemayim Chutz MiYiras Shemayim. Everything is in the hands of heaven except for awe, reverence for heaven. However, the Gemara also says, Baruch Tzuvos, that everything is in the hands of heaven except for Tzinim Pachim. There are different ways to translate Tzinim Pachim, heat and cold, chills and fevers. There are different explanations for it, but the point is that regarding that, the Gemara says, you're a fool if you expose yourself to this kind of risk. So he says, that's what it's talking about. Yes?
At least the Gemara seems to apply more
with
the
Day of
Hod.
That's Shomer
Pstayin.
Yes.
And yet we're treating it almost like the
Chatzimah. Well, where you have a justification for engaging in the activity, we are. You're right. The Gemara's language is, how in the world can we do this? Well, Hashem guards the fools. It doesn't sound like a ringing endorsement. Nonetheless, where you have a justification such as Bris Milah, or bloodletting, which was considered to be a method for preserving health.
Yeah, they're not saying in terms of a chatzila, normally to have brief class on the
government. Yes.
They say, why do we allow it to take place today? Because people trample over it.
Well,
that's a very different kind of approach.
But it's not, especially because, again, it's using cases besides the Brit Mila case, like the contraception question for the woman who shouldn't become pregnant.
Is that a Gemara?
That's a Gemara. That's a Gemara as well. Yeah. I'm blanking now on where, but yes, it is. So the Sorai Blech comments that you're not entitled to say, well, people do this, and therefore I'm okay doing it. And not only that, the Chasam Sofer makes a point quoting the Trumas Hadeshim, which I brought you in number 19. The pasuk we quote says, God guards the fools. You consider yourself a fool? He says, if you're a Talmud Chacham, you're not entitled to rely on this. You have a greater responsibility. Not to mention, when you're dealing with vaccination, Dr. Daniel Eisenberg makes a very important point in number 20. He says, the idea that God guards the fools or watches over the simple, as he translated in the text that I brought you in number 20, is for cases of risk that are generally accepted by the community. But if you live in a society in which people actually vaccinate, then you can't say God guards the fools, people always take this risk. They don't take this risk. I don't know the percentage of society that vaccinates, or so let's say that specifically the childhood vaccinations. My impression is it's awfully high. Does anybody know statistics for this? Is it safe to say we're talking about 95% or more that does childhood vaccines? 90 for sure in most communities. That's the answer that I'm getting.
Well, that puts the risk higher in those pockets.
Right.
Well, that becomes an issue.
Correct.
It's a median as opposed to a mean.
Right. I mean, my point in saying this is simply to say that you can't argue God guards the fools and people trample this all the time if they actually don't. If people don't take this risk. And that's Dr. Eisenberg's point, and I think it's an important one. Not to mention, we are generally instructed to watch out for risk. Rav Moshe Feinstein notes the following. The Gemara talks about a particular case. Those who have learned Gemara to any extent have probably come across this. Also those who have European grandparents. The principle of Mayim Megulin. Mayim Megulin means what? water that's been left exposed, right? The idea that if you have liquids out on the table Friday night, you don't leave the pitcher of water out on the table and then drink from it the next morning. You have to pour it out, cover it up, whatever it is. And the Gemara talks about a concern that snakes might have come along and injected venom into it when drinking from it. It is true, people aren't aware of this, particularly people who live in climates like Canada. There's a difference between biters and spitters, and there are indeed snakes that may well cause venom to enter a liquid. But Rav Moshe says, even in the days of the Gemara, that was an extremely rare possibility. But we were warned, be careful about things like this. Rav Moshe and Aruch Chaim Beis Tshuva Kuf, and Rabbi Asher Bush talks about this at length, but I'm not going to do the at length part because of time. But the bottom line, and what emerges, I think, from what we've seen so far, and now we have to get into vaccines, is that I have a mitzvah of guarding against danger, both a prohibition against allowing danger to be present and entering into it, as well as an active mitzvah of protecting myself from harm. There is a level at which we say, well, that's not significant, but number one, that may be where it's a low-level risk that is in the future and I have a justification for what I'm doing. And number two, that doesn't mean I can just say, well, then I'm now good and I can take the risk. If you have a means of protecting yourself from it, you have an obligation to do so. That's the 1 second digest of what we've said. But now let's get to the question of vaccines and the question of, does a vaccine qualify as a proper protective step, and how does it qualify? So to begin with, how does a new therapy or treatment become accepted as halachic medical advice? So I am obligated to follow general medical advice where it is presented as definitive. That's a basic rule. I brought you Rav Moshe Feinstein in source number 21, talking about a case in which a patient is afraid of what a doctor considers to be a life-saving treatment. He says, if a patient's refusal is because he doesn't trust the doctors, they must find a doctor he trusts. If there is no such doctor, and the disease is such that we cannot wait for him to understand this is for his own good, and we cannot send him to another hospital and doctors in another town, then the doctors here must treat him against his will. If all the doctors in this hospital believe this is the way to cure him. I want to emphasize here, number one, this is not intended to be an instruction to lose your license. Number two, we're not talking about the question of a patient who says, I don't want to live anymore, I'm suffering. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about where a patient says, I want to live, and I want treatment in order to cure what I'm dealing with. I just think the doctor is wrong. And every doctor you consult says, no, this is what you do in order to save this person's life. That's what Rav Moshe is talking about, and yes, he's trampling on patient autonomy. But that's what you see in number 21. And he says, do it in a way that you won't frighten him and so forth and fine. But the point is, there is an obligation to take the approach that the physicians prescribe when that's their prescription. That's considered common medical knowledge. Rav Yaakov Emden in source number 22 says, if the doctor doesn't know, that's another story. But indeed, that is another story. That's not our case. I'm just looking at my sheet. Oh, okay, there is another sheet page. Good. And if the doctor acknowledges that it's dangerous in source number 23, that may be yet another, another concern. It is logical to say, Rav Moshe says, it is logical to say that when most patients live from the treatment, he is obligated to undergo the treatment. But if the odds are even, it's 50-50, then it's logical to say we should not obligate the patient. If he is concerned for his definite short-term life, he doesn't want to enter into possibly losing that life for the possibility of gaining more time, he certainly is licensed. What Rav Moshe says, and I'm rushing a little bit too much with this, so let me just take a second to unpack it. What Rav Moshe is saying is, if a doctor acknowledges this isn't a guarantee, this really may not work out, it's 50-50 or worse, that you may not survive this treatment, the patient is entitled to say, you know what, without the treatment you say I'll survive a week, I'll take the week. Even if you believe that the result of this could be that I'll be healthy for a year, I'll take the week that I know I have. The patient is entitled at that level. But only where the doctor is saying, you know, this is a 50-50 situation. If the doctor is saying, this is what you do, and all the doctors are in agreement that this is what you do, that's a different story. Leah.
Can we extrapolate from this more severe morbidity as well? Because this is, you're talking only alive and dead. But what
right.
about paralysis or...
Right, so this does get extrapolated beyond this. It isn't only about the life or death dramatic case that Ramosha is discussing, although the ability to compel somebody goes down with the degree of risk. Yeah, that's to be understood. So what do we look for in terms of trusting a new treatment? We look for sound technique and public acceptance. The Rambam wrote in Mora Nevuchim, Guide to the Perplexed, in source number 24, that we look for proper theory, or we look for for effectiveness. Either if you can explain how this works, or the medicine is proven by experience, that's how we come to trust that it's valid. Moshe Sofer, the Chasam Sofer, in source number 25, says you look for testing. Did it work or didn't it work? We look for the expertise of the practitioner. We want to get a practitioner who knows what he's doing. Rav Yaakov Emden, in source number 26, says, if you have an expert physician, that's whose advice you go with. And the Chidar of Chaim Yosef David Azulai, in source number 27, echoed by many others, says you look for board certification. If somebody is board certified, that's somebody we are going to trust. Overall, what we want is standard medical practice that has been developed by experience, that is backed by theory, and that the experts say works. That's what we are looking for. But now let's go to the other side, because some people here may be wondering, isn't there another side, and when is Turchina going to get to it? There is also a camp of people who are very vocal, who say vaccines are dangerous. They are associated with all sorts of risks. You've heard about the article from Lancet a bunch of years ago that claimed that they lead to autism. You also know that Wakefield, one of the principal authors of the study, both principal authors of the study lost their license, one got it back. There were accusations of fraud in the data. There were ethical issues involved in the way that the study was carried out. But fundamentally, you find people who will claim levels of risk with what are considered basic childhood vaccines. So what do we do with those concerns? So honestly, I did a lot of reading of articles that claim that the vaccine movement is being supported by the drug companies and that it's all about money and the medical establishment and so on and so forth. I am not a doctor. I'm not a statistician. However, I will say that when those articles appear in the context of halacha, they tend to be very shoddy in their use of halacha, and that doesn't bode well for their use of medicine. And I'll give you particular examples. There's a website, which I will now call out in this year, called enrichedparenting.org. And they have a series of articles on their website in which they argue that people should not be forced to vaccinate their children, that vaccines are associated with danger, that they're being promoted by the medical establishment, and so forth. And honestly, they make certain points which are correct. One point that they make in their halachic argument, for example, is that within the realm of halacha, when we talk about majority opinion, if you have 20 rabbis who are all students of one rabbi, and they all present his opinion, they don't count as a majority because there are 20 of them. They count as only one. So they make the argument that the same thing is true with medical opinion. Meaning, if the entire Academy of Pediatrics all said that you should vaccinate, but it's because the individual pediatricians didn't do the research themselves, they just accepted the statement that they were told that vaccination is important, they count as one voice. They don't count as 20 voices, 50 voices, or 100 voices, or 1,000 voices. And that's a point that's valid. In other words, I don't want to take away from the statement that they're making. That's a valid halachic point. Yes?
If you want to reverse that rationale, or shoddy medical voice raised by a pulse, you go back to your number two, where they make the outrageous statement that very high percentage of vaccinated individuals.
Right. I'm going the other way with it right now in terms of the halachic statement. But yes. Yeah, no, absolutely true. They do make certain points which I do think are worthy of consideration. However, overall, what you will find in those articles and what you find on that particular website that I cited, the halacha that they're using is inappropriate. Meaning, for example, I'll give you a particular case. I didn't even want to put them on the sheet because I don't want to give them credence. But I will. When I send out the bibliography later by email, I'll also send you a link to the website so you can read what they said. But they make the argument that Rav Moshe prohibits invasive preventative medicine. In other words, if you wanted to use a vaccine and say, well, I need to prevent future risk, Rav Moshe will not allow invasive preventative medicine. That's their argument. However, what Rav Moshe is actually talking about, the tshuva that they quote, and they're bold enough that they actually put the reference, I don't know if they actually expect you to read it, but it's Rav Moshe talking about somebody who's going to have trouble fasting on Yom Kippur, and the question of whether that person should take an IV in order to enable them to fast on Yom Kippur. And Rav Moshe there says that you don't need to take that... you don't need to take that tack of taking the IV. That's not an isser on preventative medicine that's invasive. And they give you a second quote of another tshuva of Rav Moshe regarding children. However, the tshuva of Rav Moshe is talking about general anesthesia for a child who's going to have a bris. Again, it's not about preventative medicine in general, and it's certainly not about invasive preventative medicine, and it's certainly not in the context of vaccines. In another example from another of their articles, they make the argument that if you're going to require vaccination in order to insulate society from risk, you are requiring a healthy person to assume a risk for the sake of protecting others. And they say, we don't require people to assume risk in order to protect others. And they point you to the Radvaz, right? The classic discussion about somebody who is told that they're going to cut off a limb of his, or they're going to kill somebody else. We require him to cut off his limb, or to have his limb cut off, in order to save the life of another individual. That's what they quote as their basis for it. Ignoring the fact that, number one, cutting off a limb is not the same thing as experiencing a vaccination. But number two, and more important, the vaccination is not only for the sake of society, it's also for the sake of the person being vaccinated. It's not a simple case of take a risk on behalf of somebody else or experience harm for the sake of somebody else. It's actually about your own position as well. There are more examples of this, but the bottom line is that you have to be very careful when you read these articles, because if their halacha is this shoddy, then I'm not so sure that I want to read their medicine and trust that either. It's something that you have to be very careful of, especially because, you know, they use big words, and they sound very good. They quote an association of physicians, which only once you go to their website do you realize, yeah, this isn't exactly the same as the American Association of Pediatrics and so forth. In truth, getting past the question of this particular group and website or whatever, we have a long history of accepting medications and therapies with unknown dangers. Meaning, saying, I am going to do what medicine tells me to do, even though there actually could be harm that would come from it. Take a look, please, on your sheet at source number 28. You're familiar with the pasuk v'rapo yirapeh, which the Gemara says is the basis for permission for physicians to heal, right? The Gemara says, from the fact that the Torah says that if one person wounds another, he has to pay for the medical bills, that tells me that there is such a thing as medical bills, and there is such a thing as healing, and that tells me that doctors are allowed to heal. Asks everybody under the sun, why do you need permission for doctors to heal? Of course they should heal. Lo samad al dam reyacha. You're not allowed to stand by while somebody else is suffering. How in the world could you think that you're not supposed to heal? And one of the classic answers comes from Ramban in this source number 28, in which he says, because you might say, in the process of trying to heal somebody, I may end up hurting him. That's a fear. That's a danger. You might have said, therefore, I should not heal. I should not engage in medicine at all. And the answer is no. V'rapo yirapeh. You do it anyway. And as Rav Kook explained it in a tshuva in Das Kohen, tshuva kuf mem, it's a good Samaritan law. Lest you say, I don't have permission to intervene because I might harm. The answer is no. You absolutely do intervene. And this is seen also in the advice given by the Maharil, and it's brought in the Rama, in source number 29, talking about a city in which there is a plague. He says you should flee a city when there is a plague present, and you flee at the start of the plague. Don't wait. You should go right away. You're supposed to get out of the city. So Rav Asher Bush on this says, you know, the risks in vaccination are no greater than the risk you would have faced in the time of the Ramah, the 16th century, or the time of the Ma'aril, the 14th century, in fleeing a city. When you pick up and move, right, economic risk and health risk, this is the, you know, it's not simple and straightforward. And yet, they said, get out of the city in order to protect yourself from the epidemic. The Refuah V'Chaim, Rav Chaim Palagi, notes it as well, discussing the risks involved in fleeing in the 19th century, and he says that you go anyway. And we saw it already earlier when we talked about analyzing acceptable risk. There is such a thing as acceptable risk, and if the vaccine fits within that, and the disease does not, then we're going to say you have to take the acceptable risk of the vaccination. So what is considered to be an acceptable risk? So I thought this was very interesting. There was an issue in the time of the Chassid Sofer, going back to the 18th century, in which the authorities had demanded that burial be delayed by 3 days. Our practice is to bury right away. And they said, you have to wait 3 days. Why? Because maybe the person is still alive. And God forbid, you end up burying the person, and the person is actually still alive. And the answer of the Chidah, of Chaim Yosef David Azulai, the Chassam Sofer, also wrote about this, was, we don't worry about one person in tens of thousands. Could it be that there's going to be one person like that? Yeah, but we don't worry about that, which I find a little frightening, actually. But on that basis, take a look at source number 30. Dr. Zipoth and Buchbinder, in this article, Preventive Medicine, quote Rav Schefter. Rav Herschel Schefter explains that when one's risk of developing disease is a miud hamatsoi, small yet recognizable, one will be obligated to undergo the appropriate testing for the disease. Rav Schefter suggests that a miud hamatsoi would be in the range of 10% that I mentioned before. Thus, if a person's risk were in the range of 10%, he will be obligated to be vaccinated. And then the footnote. He asserted, he, Rav Schefter, that if the adverse reaction risk for a given vaccine was in the range of 1 in 1 million, the concept of batla daito etel kol adam would be applied to mitigate an individual's fear which might have prevented him from being vaccinated. Batla daito means that a person's own view is nullified to the view of the community. If it's a 1 in a million risk, then you can't say, well, I am afraid and therefore I'm not willing to take the risk. It's too low for it to be considered something that will be halachically valid. So writes the chapter. Whether the risks really are 1 in a million, I can't speak to. I have read research that suggested it, but I don't know enough about which research is valid to say this one in particular is correct. But that has been classically the dominant approach regarding vaccination. The approach that says that if your risk is at a tolerable level, you take the vaccine. And even if the risk is above the tolerable level, but lower than the risk from the disease, it often is recommended. And this comes up, it comes up in the context of vaccines today. Dr. Eisenberg, in the article that I referred to earlier, noted that the U.S. has switched from the Sabin live poliovirus to the Salk dead poliovirus. Even though the immunity is not as good, as I understand it from the article, the live virus will trigger immunity not only in the person who's being vaccinated, but also in those who are around, who didn't get vaccinated directly, but they'll get it because they're going to contract the weakened live virus from the person being vaccinated, whereas the dead virus vaccine is only going to affect the person who's actually injected with it. The reason that they switched is because there is a lower level of risk with the dead virus one, and even though it's less powerful, the level of polio concern in the U.S. is currently considered low enough that they figure better to avoid any risk at all by using the dead virus vaccine. So this is a calculation that continues to be made. It's not like we just say, take all vaccines, there is no risk, and so forth. It's actually, it's a live issue, so to speak.
Okay, I'm on the backup recorder now. So, classically, the danger of disease has been treated as being greater than the danger of the vaccination. Add to that the fact that the contagion risk is viewed as being already present. Remember, we said that you're not supposed to take a risk that a risk may be tolerable if it's in the future. It's not something that's present right now. But once that future risk rises to a certain level, it's actually viewed as being present right now by halachic authorities. And for this reason, rabbis encouraged vaccination when vaccination first began. And we're talking about the smallpox period. And here there's a lot to be said that I'm going to condense into a very short period of time. But going back to the end of the 18th century, there was a work called Ale Trufa that was published by somebody who lost two children to smallpox. And he said, take the risk and vaccinate rather than undergo what he had undergone. There was a parallel statement, interestingly, from Ben Franklin, who had lost a child to smallpox as well. The article that I'm going to reference in the bibliography that I email out will, the article by Rabbi Usher Bush goes into the history much more, as does the article by Rabbi J. David Blythe that I'll reference there as well. But they promoted the smallpox vaccine. They promoted the cowpox-based one when that came out from Edward Jenner. And there was a case at the end of the 19th century in England in which the authorities imprisoned a Jew for failure to vaccinate. And he argued that Judaism said that he should not vaccinate. They went to Rabbi Herman Adler, who was the chief rabbi of England at the time, and the answer was no. The answer is that Judaism does not defend failure to vaccinate. And if he goes to prison, he goes to prison. We even find responsa on vaccinating on Shabbos, saying that where the vaccination can only be done on Shabbos, you take the vaccine on Shabbos. And, you know, they had cases in which the people who were offering the vaccination would travel from town to town. If they're in town on Shabbos and after that you're not going to be able to get it, then you get the vaccination even on Shabbos to prevent harm. And so in our own day, that tends to be the approach, to say that one is required to vaccinate. If you take a look at source number 31, not required, well, that one ought to be vaccinating and that according to some it is actually considered a firm halachic requirement. Take a look at source number 31, please. This is Rabbi Eliashiv's statement quoted by Rabbi Dr. Akiva Tatz. In fact, Rabbi Eliashiv went so far as to assert that failure to immunize would amount to negligence. Refusing childhood immunizations on the basis of unsubstantiated fears of vaccine side effects is irresponsible and out of order halachically. That's his statement. Now, I should note, the anti-vaccine group says that Rabbi Eliashiv was given incorrect medical information leading to this statement. That's their response. But we find Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, we find Rav Yeshua Neuwirth, both saying that one is supposed to do it. Rav Asher Bush, in his article, reports conversations with Rav Heschel Schechter, Rav Mordechai Willig, Rabbi J. David Bleich, all of them encouraging vaccination. Rav Zilberstein, not really a surprise because he's Rabbi Yashiv's son-in-law, but Rav Zilberstein and Shirei Torah L'Rofim, the OU/RCA, issued a statement several years ago urging vaccination as well. The one area where most of them stop short, other than Rabbi Eliashiv, is they stop short of compelling. Because they acknowledge that there is some level of risk with the vaccine, and because in our society, the risk of actually contracting the illness is still distant and is still a very small percentage. Therefore, they say if a parent says, I don't want to vaccinate my child, or if somebody says, I don't want to get a vaccine, they're not willing to compel. Okay. Last piece of this is the duty to others. The question of, what's my responsibility to other people? And if people have to leave at some point, understood, and don't feel bad. The problem came up in recent years with the epidemic that I mentioned, the summer camp epidemic and the school debate question. So first of all, is there a duty to vaccinate one's children? So as a basic principle, the obligation to support one's children is understood to include the obligation to provide medical care for one's children. The Menchas Yitzchak has a tshuva on this, Rabbi Yitzchak Weiss, and others as well. The Tzitz Eliezer of Eliezer Waldenberg wrote about this in the context of eye exams. It's considered to be an obligation. Rabbi J. David Bleich, though, goes even further. Take a look at source number 32, Gemara in Kiddushin. A father's obligations to his son are bris milah, right, circumcision, redeeming him, meaning pidyon haben, teaching him Torah, marrying him off, training him in a trade, and some say training him to swim. Teaching the child to swim so that if, God forbid, the child is ever in a position where he needs to swim in order to survive, now he'll know how to swim. So Rabbi Bleich says, well, isn't teaching a child to swim going to involve putting him in the water? Right? You're putting a child who doesn't know how to swim in the water. Isn't there a level of risk involved in teaching a child to swim? And he argues on that basis that clearly we accept a low level of risk in order to protect somebody from a higher degree of risk. And that's generally the way that it's approached. Rabbi Bleich says, well, maybe you'll argue that swimming, maybe learning to swim, that's Shomer P'sayim Hashem. That's something that people do within society. But he says the same thing is true regarding vaccination. It's something that people do within society, and people are willing to tolerate that level of risk. So it is considered to be a parental obligation for one's child. What about compelling vaccination in order to protect other people? So, in general, we don't compel somebody to take a risk in order to protect others. And that was the point raised by the Enriched Parenting website that I noted before. And that's certainly true. However, number one, we have a principle of lo samod al dam rayecha. You can't stand by while somebody else is at risk. That's number one. And number two, and I'm really condensing now just in the interest of time, there's a lot to be said with this. But number two, you are a beneficiary as well. It's not only about helping others, but you are personally a beneficiary too. And therefore, on that basis, we do say that one would need to incur the risk that will also protect others. So what about the school excluding the school children? So some halachic authorities do indeed support the school's ability to exclude. And they argue on a couple of grounds. I brought you in source number 33, Rabbi Usher Bush, arguing, he quotes Rabbi Yashiv, that the parents of vaccinated students have the right to insist all the other classmates should be vaccinated because you can't endanger my child. My child shouldn't be at risk because of your child. And that's one argument in favor of it. Rabbi J. David Bleich notes in source number 34 that schools everywhere are in the practice of excluding children for all sorts of reasons, justified and unjustified. He notes that schools will sometimes exclude children because they can't afford to pay. Schools will sometimes exclude children because they say that the children are a bad influence on the other students. There are all sorts of reasons why a school might exclude a child, and he says it's within their rights to say that you don't sacrifice the many for the few, and therefore, indeed, you can exclude the child. Rav Zilberstein gives you another approach. Rav Zilberstein quotes the Ramah in the Shulchan Aruch saying that rabbis are allowed to put somebody in cherem. They're allowed to excommunicate somebody for violating communal norms, violating halacha. Well, one of the possible applications of cherem is that his children will no longer be allowed to attend school. So how is it that you're allowed to put somebody in cherem? How is it that you're allowed to excommunicate somebody if that's going to result in the child not being able to go to school? He says clearly the answer is that that's considered to be an acceptable price to pay where the parent is not complying with halacha. Well, if so, and if I believe that there is an obligation to vaccinate, then the parent isn't following halacha, and I'm certainly within my rights to exclude the child from school. Those are the arguments that are brought in favor of excluding. The argument brought against excluding is the child needs to have a Jewish education. The last case that I want to mention is the healthcare worker case because it was specifically emailed to me. The practice of forcing healthcare workers to get a flu vaccination in order to protect the people they are taking care of. So we've already discussed on other occasions the issue of whether you're obligated to treat patients during an epidemic. Is a healthcare worker able to say, I don't want to put myself at risk? So the general rule is that assuming there are protections available to ensure the safety of the healthcare worker is obligated to use the protections and take care of the patients. That's a general statement which needs to be unpacked. If you were interested in my Ebola shear, you can find it online. But the general rule is that a doctor is obligated to treat contagious patients and just take precautions personally. So therefore, the doctor is not entitled to say, well, I'm just going to walk away and I won't treat patients and then I don't need to worry about getting a flu vaccine. What about saying, I am going to treat the patients, but I don't want to get the vaccine. So if, and this is a big if it is deemed to be required, meaning that if medical professionals using data and using experience say, you will, if you don't get vaccinated, you will be endangering the lives of the people you are taking care of, then indeed it does appear that the doctor will have to pay the price of getting vaccinated. The healthcare worker will have to pay the price of getting vaccinated. You're not entitled to endanger others. In the Ebola shear, we talked about the practice of quarantining physicians in shul, in even keeping them from shul if need be, in order to prevent them from affecting others when they contract something from their patients. There are times when one might indeed be inconvenienced, but it seems like that is considered to be appropriate. And to that, I would add the note from Rav Schechter. Rav Schechter makes a note, which I thought I included on here, but I see I did. Oh, I did. It's in source number 36, that Dina de Machusa is also going to apply. The law of the land is the law. If there is a law that requires vaccination, you will be forced to comply. I should note that in Canada, there is no law compelling vaccination. And I can send you links on that if you're interested. I did some research on it. Also, I thank Jeffrey for sending me a particular case. As a general rule, vaccination is not considered compulsory. In Ontario, it is compulsory for school children who want to attend school unless they get a note saying that it's against their conscience, it's against their religious values, and so forth, in which case they're not required to get vaccinated. There may be a particular case during a particular epidemic when things may change, but my understanding is that that's the rule more broadly. My last note here, my last source here on the sheet, I quoted Dr. Applebaum. You may remember from several years ago, the bombing in the cafe in which Dr. Applebaum and his daughter Nava were killed, and she was the one who was going to get married. She was the Kala. So there was an article that he wrote on, it was called Shmira al HaBriyot V'Achrayut Hadadit, guarding Hashem's creations and mutual responsibility. And it's a very interesting article about public health and so forth. He was an emergency room physician, I believe. But he quotes you the Gemara in source number 37. I thought it was an ideal way to conclude. The Gemara there talks about a case in which a patient is sick on Shabbos, and the doctors say he needs a fig. And 10 people go running, and they all cut figs from the trees, violating Shabbos, in order to bring him a fig. And the rule is they're all exempt from liability. They were all trying to save this person. So Dr. Applebaum asks in the article, he says, why did the Gemara give me a case in which 10 people went? Could have just given me a case in which 2 people went, one who was needed and one wasn't needed. Why did you give me 10 people went? He says, because 10 is tzibur. 10 is community. And it's emphasizing the responsibility of the community to be involved in taking care of the patient. That public health is a mitzvah for Klal Yisrael. And he writes in his article that the mitzvah is like tefillah. It's like davening. You can daven on your own or you can daven with a community. When you daven with the community, it transforms the mitzvah. Your davening is different halachically, and your davening is different qualitatively when you daven with a community. And he said the same thing is true regarding health. When the community gathers together to safeguard the health of the community, not only is it valuable for the individual, but it's also valuable for the community as a whole. Whether you take that as a herd immunity specific comment or a more broad broad statement, I thought that was very appropriate. There's a lot more to be said. I apologize for rushing through that, which I did say. I will send out, God willing, the link to the recording, as well as the source sheets and the bibliography of articles that you may want to see on the topic. If you didn't sign in, please make sure to sign in. Thank you very much.